Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Kevin Erickson, and he'll be answering your most important questions on classic salmon flies. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Kevin a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Kevin Erickson about classic salmon flies. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kickboats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at their ultimate personal flotation crafts. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. That's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Kevin, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. If you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Kevin's section that says, "Click here to register for our drawing." Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Kevin's latest book, Feathercraft, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question or questions. We may do a two-part question. We ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills. And that's the same question place where you can ask questions during the show. We use that same text box on the homepage. So our guest tonight is Kevin Erickson. Kevin is a hopeless fly fishing junkie for life, like most of us, I suppose. From his first job working at the Grease Blind Fly Shop in Vancouver, Washington in the 80s, then Kaufman Stream Board for over 15 years. To the present, he has traveled the world fishing extensively in both fresh and salt water and taught literally thousands of people how to cast, fish, and tie flies. He recently wrote a book just released by Stackpole Books titled Feathercraft, The Amazing Birds and Feathers Used in Classic Salmon Flies. Over 40 years in the making and currently receiving rave reviews. Kevin, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me and look forward to getting a chance to talk salmon flies and fishing in general.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So we've got quite a few questions here. And I know a lot of us fly fishers aren't that familiar with salmon flies. It's almost like this exclusive little club that exists out there in my mind. And of very fine tires. And maybe that's why I don't go there, because I don't figure I can tie that well. But maybe you can kind of enlighten us and entice some of us tonight into the art that you so love. So let's just start out. You know, what is, you know, the definition of a classic salmon fly?
Well, the traditional patterns that were developed became pretty elaborate, and mainly it's defining a fly used to fish for Atlantic salmon that incorporated feathers in the construction. They were either simple strips of turkey or other materials in the wings, all the way through to married or built wings of multiple different bird feather strips. and some would incorporate up to 30 to 35 different materials in each individual fly. So it's something that definitely was used in fish for Atlantic salmon, and it became kind of almost a competition between the tires and the gillies or guides to be able to create something unique for their guests. So it's something that... Go ahead.
I was going to ask you about the history of the salmon fly. Where did this originate? Was it in the UK, or was it in the United States, or where?
Yeah, Europe, and a lot of them were developed in the 1700s, 1800s, as the explorers traveled the world, developing different areas and building new colonies and bringing back all the materials and products that they came across, including all the exotic birds. They were materials that became available for the tires to use and incorporate, and it was a case where they just kind of started going wild with different ways to incorporate all these exotic materials into the flies.
And were these were there traditional patterns? I mean, is this when you go out to tie a fly today, do most people try to use certain patterns that are classic or traditional?
Yeah, there are some books that were written back even in the early 1800s that started to describe specific pattern recipes. The different authors, some of the most famous ones were The Salmon Fly by George Kelson, and T.E. Price Tannett wrote books on tying the salmon flies. And so the patterns formalized and started to develop over time, and especially early on they were somewhat kind of haphazard as far as how they were made, but as the publications came around and things got standardized, there were definitely formal recipes that are followed. But
now,
in current day, there are patterns that are created called artistic styles, and just new versions that are developed based on the materials that are available or the tire's whims.
So these classic salmon flies, Scott Nelson wants to know, do they actually catch fish? Have they ever caught fish, or are they just meant for show?
They definitely do catch fish. They were actually, some were tied on the water by the gillies, the equivalent of modern-day guides for the aristocracy in Europe and other areas, and were fished. And, boy, I can't imagine tying one now. I'd probably be using about 50-pound Kevlar on my leader tippet to be sure I could pull the rock in if it got hooked up on it. They were
a
little involved in material and time to tie. But, yeah, they definitely can and do catch fish and are used.
So are they, when the salmon are coming upriver, they're not actually feeding, right? So it's more of an attractor and anger or annoyance to them when they strike?
Correct. Yeah, probably all of the above or any one of the above. As the fly swings down in front of the fish, who knows why they grab it, but they do.
Yeah, so none of these flies really are there to imitate a natural of any kind.
No, it's probably about as opposite of that as you could get. All the different colors and materials that are combined together just create a flash of different colors and a silhouette in the water that the fish see swimming along. And who knows if they grab it out of curiosity as much as anger or any other aspect.
Do people that use Atlantic salmon flies like this, do they have favorites, confidence flies like we have in trout fishing?
Oh, there's some traditional patterns. A lot of traditional patterns where materials are a little more easily available, like Green Highlander or Lady Amherst. But, no, there's so many different patterns that exist and just subtle color variations that not that many people fish them actively. It's more kind of the art of tying the fly and incorporating all the materials together. And a lot of these are for display or framing purposes or otherwise. They're very beautiful patterns to be able to look at, whether fished or not.
And why did they get so fancy?
It's hard to say, but my opinion is it probably got to be like a competition among the ghillies and the fly tiers of the day to see how many different things they could incorporate into the pattern and how many different variations on a theme they could create. It's a case where would you have more fish caught if you use yellow on top of blue instead of red? It's hard to say, but it's just kind of a variation on a theme in a lot of them.
So nowadays, tires tie, I guess, I would assume that the traditional patterns. But today, people that are really into tying salmon flies get creative today and come up with new patterns?
Oh, yes.
Is that part of the...
Yeah, there are some amazing new developments that are out there all the time, different ways the feathers are combined to make the wings and sweeping tops and bottoms on the flies and different materials like peacock pheasant and eyed feathers that just give a totally different appearance from anything that was a traditional style. So, yeah, creative and art, they're termed artistic flies, are pretty popular anymore.
And are they collected?
Yes, there are collectors, different aspects, some who collect flies that have been, traditional favorites, like the Jock Scott, for example, is one that's, if you're delving into the classic salmon fly realm, that's a pattern name that you would hear of and would be pretty popular overall. But others collect the creative flies and different, either in museums or some just for the artistic value, others just for the traditional value as far as kind of carrying on the heritage of fly fishing.
Are they cherished by, a particular artist? In other words, like our tire, I should say, like a painting would be,
There are some tires that are very highly... Bob Berverka and Michael Redensich, who has written a number of different books on classic full-dressed Atlantic salmon flies, as well as created videos that are very good, and a number of other tires who have, very high regard. So they're definitely collectible, and it's a combination of the materials that are used in the fly. Are they authentic, or are they substitutes that contribute to the value, and then also the tire as well.
What about the age?
Of the patterns? Yeah, the traditional.
Tied in the 1920s or something like that, does it have more value?
Yeah. If you can find antiques, those are definitely collectible, and they're identifiable in different ways between the hook itself that was used and the condition of the materials, and some of them are even tagged to a degree and kind of follow along from who tied them as far as information about the fly. So, yeah, the antique full-dress flies are definitely collectible and can be something fun to put together either in a frame or have a wallet of traditional flies to be able to share and examine and compare with what's tied currently.
So anything collectible usually has some kind of monetary value. So what does a collectible fly sell for? I mean, what have you seen?
Well, I've seen like some of Michael Redensich's patterns listed on his website for up to $1,000 a fly.
Wow.
And then others, some patterns that are noted and identified and authenticated with certain tires can be in the thousands of dollars each. So, they're definitely sought after in different areas all over the world. There are collectors in the U.S. and Europe and Japan and pretty much everywhere.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And are they tied to, are they generally for the artistic purposes, are they tied at dimensions that it would normally be fished, or are there versions that are extra large for display or something like that?
Yeah, they tend to be larger patterns. The more desirable are the larger flies. It's more difficult to get the materials for those, but just the ability to appreciate and see the detail and different layers that are involved, it usually are, the larger hooks are sought after. You know, 2-aught, 4-aught, the flies I tied from my book, I was able to find anywhere from 5-aught to 7-aught. So the flies themselves get to be literally over 3 inches long. But for me, that was good in that I wanted larger flies that would be better to photograph and just have something that would be kind of hopefully down the road collectible and would display nicely. You get a size 4 or 6, it's, you know, almost hard get out the magnifying glass to really start seeing the detail on them.
Yeah, yeah. You know, some of these things I've seen in frames and so forth, you know, you're only seeing one side of them. But those that are in the frames, are they actually tied fully? I mean, they're a complete fly. They're not just, we're not just seeing half a fly or anything, are we?
It depends on who ties them and what's put together. I've done some before myself that were only half flies, you know, just the front half, just because it was kind of a mix of patterns. And, you know, the materials get to be hard to find and pretty expensive. So depending on what the person wants for them. But, you know, to really do it correct, you want to have both sides and have a fly you could take out and have. And then some of the displays now, they're starting to get, you know, equivalent to like baseball card holders or something where the fly is suspended within a clear case or a square display that you can be able to hold in hand and rotate around and see everything, both sides, top, bottom, what have you.
Wow. Well, cool. Cool. Well, let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come back and we'll start talking about how to tie these things. So hold on, and we'll be right back. Looking for that shot at a permit? Whipray Key Fishing Lodge in Belize is where you want to be. When you stay at Whipray Key Fishing Lodge, you're on a private island and are only minutes away from some of the finest permit fishing in Belize. Whipray Key is just a 30-minute boat ride from Placencia. Once you are there, you'll be fishing Permit Alley, one of Belize's best fisheries, and it won't take you long boat rides to get there. You'll fish with world-class guides like Daniel Cabral, whose family has fished the area for over 30 years. Want to switch it up and fish for tarpon and bonefish and make it a grand slam? They can make it happen at Whipray Key Fishing Lodge. Book your next adventure now. Visit whipraykeyfishinglodge.com. That's Whipray, C-A-Y-E, fishinglodge.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Kevin Erickson about classic salmon flies. If you'd like to ask Kevin a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately. We'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Kevin, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world. So, you know, this book was recently published, right? So I'm sure that was a, well, you said many years in the making, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, between collecting and learning how to tie them, it's been over 40 years, but the actual production of the book took about 3 years between photographing everything and writing the content and tying all the flies. And I had someone ask me the other day about the fly tying itself for the book, and each pattern took a day and a half as far as, you know, I'd have a register set up for where I'd rotate the vise around and take a picture. So I'd start out attaching the thread, stop, rotate the vise around, take a picture of that step, and then rotate it back where I could actually work on it and tie in the tip and the tag and the tail and the butt and so forth. And each one of those individual steps, I'd have to stop and rotate the fly around and take a picture of it. So each pattern in the book has about 25 to 30 photos step-by-step showing how it's made.
Wow.
So that took quite a while, too. So
Yeah,
otherwise I've been going out and doing some book signings at Barnes & Noble and some of the local shops and other bookstores. And I'm scheduled to be tying at the November Fly Tires, Northwest Fly Tires Rendezvous in Portland, and then in March at the Albany, Oregon Federation of Fly Fishers, or Federation Fly Fishers International now show in Albany, Oregon, which is pretty popular in March.
Good, good, good. Well, now, and you have a website you can share with people to
The quickest way to get there is go to www.feathercraftbook.com.
Okay, and they can get the book right there online?
Yes, you can order a signed copy online there. I've got a lot of the content of the book shown in photos. I have images of all of the flies, and then when you click on a given fly, I've put up PDF pattern listings, so you'll see a good-sized photo of the finished fly along with the material list for each pattern. So if you want to try and tie them, you can pull that up and print out and work from it. And photos of all of the bird paintings I commissioned and had done, and then also some different feather photos. So a fair bit of the content, so you can kind of get a sense of what the book's all about.
Good. And have you written any other books on salmon flies or anything else?
Not books, but I have written a lot of articles for Fly Fishing and Tying Journal magazine, Frank Amato's publication, over the years, and actually going to be starting to do that again now for this next year coming up.
That's one of the gifts we give away or prizes, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal subscription. So, good. Okay, good. Well, thanks for sharing that with us, and thanks for producing such a beautiful book, too. I mean, it's just fun to look at the pictures, good job.
A lot of people have a lot of different motives for writing a book. Mine was really just, here I've collected all these materials and, just wanted to share all those different birds and feathers. And then also, I've always enjoyed teaching, so I wanted to share the steps on how to make them, and just hopefully people will have a easier chance of getting started and getting into tying the classics from that, and that'll help them out.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, let's talk about tying. We got a question from Travis in Fargo. I assume that's Fargo, North Dakota. He says, how does one get started tying classic salmon flies? Is there a sequence of patterns that helps to build skills, recommended books? So what would, and I'm assuming most people don't go into tying just directly into tying salmon flies, that they've probably had some other experience tying trout flies or whatever. So from there, what would your recommendations be?
Yeah, definitely a good question. There's a variety of different patterns. It would depend on how gung-ho you are and how much you want to dive into it. It's kind of a two-step process. Part of it is collecting the materials to be able to tie the patterns, and that takes a bit, unless you have a unlimited budget and want to just try and get everything all at once. But I'd suggest tying what are called simple strip flies. They're flies that use maybe some turkey quills as an underwing and maybe some teal or mallard flank as overwings. There's the blue charm is a good pattern for that style. And, finding some flies that you like and tie. If you want to get into the married wing, built wing flies that incorporate multiple different materials and colors of materials within the wing itself, the Doctor series of patterns are good. There's a blue Doctor, a black Doctor, silver Doctor, and a couple others, I believe. There's too many to keep track of almost, but they're simpler materials, just colored, usually reds and blues and yellows incorporated together, and simpler bodies, and those are a good one to get into building the wings and tying. And then if someone really wants to get good at tying in the wings on the full dress flies, I highly recommend learning how to tie muddler minnows really well. The fly shop I worked at in Vancouver, Washington, the Grease Line, that was a mainstay fly there, was the muddler minnow. And I tied tens of thousands of those and learned how to set that turkey quill wing so it was like a knife edge when you looked at it from the top. And there are certain tricks you can do for that. And anybody is welcome to email me, and I can go through in detail what those steps are. But if you can get the wing tied in without an underwing, which the muddler doesn't have really compared to full dress flies, then it's actually easier to tie the married wing full dress flies and get the wing to set correctly. So practice tying muddlers and start with the Doctor series, and you'll be in pretty good shape to move along.
Okay, now as far as recommended books, of course yours, Feathercraft.
Well, that's one that's readily available right now, but I actually literally in front of me have what I started with is Paul Jorgensen's book called Salmon Flies, Their Character, Style, and Dressing. And occasionally you can still find that available in some good fly shops and find it online. I think I picked up this copy of late on eBay even. Just, you know, it's not readily available, but it's around. And then the others that are excellent are Michael Radencich's books. He has a whole series of different books on tying classic salmon flies. And also, to me, the best is his video series. He goes through start to finish tying a Jock Scott and shows that he has just excellent close-up detail of tying every part of the fly, from attaching the thread to building up the underbody after you've attached the gut eye, tying in the tip, the tag, the tail, the butt, and all the other parts, and just is excellent and highly recommended to go through. Even if you're not going to tie that fly, you're going to learn the steps, how to build a wing, how to put in the hackle or throat, so no matter what you tie, you're going to have the right process for doing it.
Now, are those videos available for free on YouTube, or are they something you sell?
No, there are some that you'd have to purchase, and you can get them from Michael Radencich on his website. And let's see if I can pull that up here just while we're at it so you could get the web address. And
I know I do have
those
one.
Are,
go ahead.
Yeah, it's... let's see. Yeah, I'll have to get that, and I can provide to anybody who wants it. It's RadencichSalmonFlies.com. So RadencichSalmonFlies SalmonFlies.com. He's got a great website, shows some artistic flies, traditional patterns, and you can order his videos and books there too.
Okay. Okay, good. Good. Yeah, I'm trying to, let's see here. I'm trying to think of when it was. Yeah, we did a show with Mike. It's been quite a while. Called Tying the Classic Salmon Fly. So those of you on our site can go and find that in the archive. And so that would be another. I think that's the only other show we've done on salmon flies. So between this one and that one, you ought to have a good start with getting started with salmon flies. So yeah, there's well, he sent me a picture that we put on the website, Anthony's Queen. It's quite the piece of work. Yeah.
And I
like
do have
Cirque
a link.
Cirque du Soleil performer or something.
Oh yeah, yeah. They get those artistic flies. Get pretty sweeping wings.
Yeah.
And if anybody needs, I have a link to his site. I just looked, and I've got a link to his website on my site in the links area.
Right, right. Yeah, and likewise, we have one on his page, on his speaker's page here on Ask About Flies. So lots of ways you can get connected there. But, yeah, he's one of the gurus in the industry, as you say. Huh?
Yes.
So, yeah, good. And
I always felt, too, that one thing that's good is if you can find a resource or someone who does tie classic flies, you know, try and connect with them and learn from them. I was really fortunate in that I had one of the recognized best classic salmon fly tiers ever in William Chin Jr., Bill Chin, lived fairly close. He would come into the grease line and then also came into the Kaufman's where I'd worked, and would come in with this small wooden box that was fleece lined and would open it and show us his latest pattern that he had tied up. And I had a forward or a endorsement section written by Dave McNeese, and he pretty much nailed it. It's like when Bill came into the shop and would show those flies, it was like being able to see Marilyn Monroe in the nude. It was just something that was pretty amazing as far as the quality of his flies, and just they were immaculate, and they were the best you could get at any time, and he still set the standard as far as the tying goes.
Wow, wow, cool. Well, we had Travis in Fargo had another question. He said, well, could you recommend some relatively simple utilitarian classic salmon flies for someone who doesn't want to go all in on the more complicated patterns? So would you, maybe you've already answered that, would be that simple strip?
The blue charm would be good, and then to get into married wing pattern, that doctor series is a good choice too. And then there are different styles of flies that kind of fall into the classic salmon fly realm. There are spey flies and D flies, which are long, flowing, hackled flies where a lot of people use like pheasant rump or blue-eared pheasant for substitutes for what traditionally was used was gray heron, which is illegal to have and for a reason. And these other materials work pretty well as far as alternatives. So different different combinations you can put together. And some tires will kind of combine things in that they'll tie a spey-style fly that traditionally has a simple bronze mallard or turkey wing, and they'll tie and start kind of easing into the married wings where you're joining together different strips of different colors and making a wing that way. So, you know, just be creative and have fun with it. And, you know, then you can start working on getting the traditional by-the-book classics built up once you get your techniques down.
Okay, okay. Well, can you, I know in your book you did this, so I'm hoping you can kind of describe it on the show tonight, is, you know, the basic, break down the basic parts of a salmon fly. And maybe, you know, because it seems like there's obviously more to it than we would think of it in a standard streamer, you know, for trout. So can you kind of talk about the different parts and how they relate to one another?
Yeah, the traditional flies, meaning back in the 1700s and 1800s, they actually started out with a twisted silkworm gut loop to make an eye on the hook. The hooks were blind. They did not have a round, folded metal eye. So they had to create an eye to be able to attach their leader to. So first thing they would typically put on the hook would be the twisted silkworm gut eye and secure that along the length of the hook. And then start out in the back with a tip, which was typically a wrap of three or four turns of metallic tinsel, and then a tag, which would extend from the barb up to the point, which a lot of times was yellow floss, but could be other colors or other materials. The tail could consist of normally a golden pheasant crest, but could be other materials, and sometimes had other things laid on top of that golden pheasant crest, Indian crow and other things for different textures and color touches in there. And then there's a butt, which would be right above the point of the hook, and that normally is either black ostrich hurl or could be yarn. And then the body of the fly could vary a lot, either flosses or tinsels, sometimes dubbings, sometimes peacock hurl. And it could be one long body, like on the Silver Doctor, it's silver tinsel from back to front all the way. The Jock Scott is broken up with yellow floss in the back half and a ostrich hurl butt in the middle and black floss in the front half, so mixed colors. Some flies have ribbing over the individual halves of the fly. Others, like the Silver Doctor, just has one wrap of ribbing over the whole body. Traditionally, it's five turns of ribbing for a classic style fly. And then sometimes you'd have veilings, which are feathers that are laying flat over the body. In the back half on the Jock Scott, for example, it'd have a veiling of toucan feathers, the breast feathers, kind of a yellowish-golden color, top and bottom laying flat to give more color and movement.
Is that tied in at the back end, the front of the body there?
It would be tied in the middle of the body and then extend back to the rear butt, top and bottom.
But tied in at the butt, too? or is that
tied in the middle of the body? So you'd have a
they float
technically,
back.
Yeah, they'd flow back toward the back of the fly. You'd have a ostrichural butt right at the tail, and then another section in the middle, which technically is called a joint between the two halves of the body. They'd wrap, tie in those valines top and bottom, and then wrap that joint of black ostrichural in the middle of the body to kind of cover up that work.
Okay.
And then you'd carry forward with, on the Josh Scott, more black floss, and it would have flat silver ribbing and oval silver ribbing right behind that, and a black hackle kind of palmered over the front half of the body. And then from there you would actually proceed on and tie the wing. So the underwing was white tip turkey tail, and then a built up wing of 3 to 5 strands of each individual material that was called for. So on the Jock Scott it has peacock wing on the bottom, and then next would be yellow swan above that, red swan, blue swan, and then florican or speckled bustard, florican bustard, and golden pheasant tail. All those different feathers, about 3 or 4 fibers of each, married together. And the makeup of the feathers on the birds is one of the fascinating things about this process. All of the birds have feathers that are physically similar. They have barbs and barbules, and on each barbule are what are called hooklets. It's kind of almost like nature's Velcro system. So you can take a strand of peacock wing and take a strand of swan wing and touch those together and kind of wiggle them and weave them together, and they will join together because those hooklets are the same on both. And then you can take bustard and marry that to the swan, and you can take golden pheasant and marry that to the bustard. And because the physical properties in those hooklets are similar on every bird, it'll let you marry those strands together and create a built wing. And then that gets tied in, and you have shoulders and sides and cheeks and then toppings and the upper edge wing, and then the head of the fly and the throat in there after you've built the wing. So it can be to be a lot of materials crammed in on a hook.
Yeah, how many different materials, whether it be floss, the feathers, or do some of these really complex flies have on them?
Some have up to 30 to 35 materials in each fly.
Wow. Wow.
That's where
no wonder they're a piece of art.
Tying these is... Yeah. It's, you know, half the battle in tying them is collecting all the materials so you could tie one fly.
So that's part of the joy and challenge is getting good materials.
Yeah. It's pretty much a case if you go into a fly shop and you see something you think might work good, you better get it, because if you don't, somebody else probably will. And if you have it, you're probably going to tend to use it just because you have it. So it's not as if it'll sit there and go to waste. It's just, you know, not commonly available things. But there are some good sources now that are starting to make materials available, both authentic and substitutes, too.
Is there, I know there was a question later about that, but since you just brought it up, what are there some places online that people can go to that... that specialize in salmon fly materials?
Yes, I've got links to a few of them, but some of my favorites are, that's a website called featherfreak.com. A gentleman named Doug Millsap has built up a pretty extensive supply of materials. There's some authentic that he's bought at like estate sales and other things and makes available, but he has some outstanding substitutes for some of the rare and hard to get a hold of winging materials. He actually bought a business from Europe that a gentleman had developed for dyeing and creating substitutes for bustard and other exotic birds using turkey quills. So they are nice, long fibers, and they work very well for larger flies, and you can not be trying to find actual authentic materials that could be very difficult or very expensive, these substitutes work very well and let you tie a lot of the traditional patterns. Mm-hmm. Also is feathersmc.com is John McLean's website, is very good for that as well. And AO as in Apple Oscar, aofeathers.com is the gentleman who's actually not too far away here in St. Helens, has some good materials too.
Okay, great, great. Sounds like some good. Now, are these all feather places or do they also have hooks and feather materials that you might need?
Pretty much everything as far as hooks for tying the classic full dress flies or spay flies or whatever you want. Hooks and threads and flosses and tinsels and feathers. A lot of the focus is on the feathers, but most of them do also have hooks and other materials needed to be able to get everything you'd need to tie some flies with.
Yeah, yeah. Good, good. Okay. So what, you know, you've mentioned this a number of times now. You know, part of the preparation for tying a fly is getting the materials. So once you have all the materials, do you go through any other preparation to get ready to tie that's different maybe than we would to tie a, you know, a trout fly of much simpler nature?
Yeah, one thing that is good to get and have are silk gloves. I've found some at Land's End, but you can find them elsewhere, in that if you're working with silks and even some of the finer tinsels, the silk gloves allow you to handle those materials without getting them dirty and without fraying them. That really helps a lot, and you'll see Michael Redensich using that on his video anytime he's handling flosses. It does make a big difference.
Otherwise, they spray it, and that doesn't look good on the fly, I take it. Huh?
Oh, yeah. If you handle them with bare fingers, even if you – I've known people that have used, like, sandstone to polish their fingers and washed them 10 times, you still start having natural oils that come out in your fingers, and just handling them, your fingers compared to the floss are pretty coarse and pretty rough. So those silk gloves do make a big difference.
But
other real different materials that – I'd get a top quality pair of good, sharp, fine pointed scissors to get in there with. And otherwise, you know, really pretty minimal on the material, on the tools. In reality, in the old days, 1700s, 1800s, if you're right-handed tier, your left hand was your vise. You'd hold the hook in your left hand and your bobbin, your spool of thread, you'd hold that in your right hand and your right hand was your bobbin. Everything was tied entirely by hand with no tools. So talk about adding a little more complexity to the fly. That would do it. But
I noticed in your vise jaws you seem to have some kind of padding in there to probably protect the hook.
Yes, it's a good idea. I get like a little piece of note card, 3x5 note card, and I'll cut out a little square of that. And then I put a piece of cellophane, just clear scotch tape over that, and I fold the scotch tape on the inside and clamp the hook and the vise with that piece of paper folded over the hook itself to protect the finish.
And so
especially on the bigger hooks, you can start pulling on them pretty hard, and you don't want to damage the finish on the hook by having it moving around in the jaws.
And are you always tying on black hooks? Is that...
That's traditionally the style, is they call it a black Japan finish, where it's kind of a baked-on enamel. But there's a gentleman in Japan now I've been watching on Facebook who's actually producing some very interesting colored hooks. He'll have, like, black and red modeled, or gold and red and different colors together that really look pretty enticing. I think I'm going to have to get some of those and do some experimentation with them.
And the hooks that you do tie, the classic salmon fly, are the hooks without an eye? Or
the ones I did in the book in the traditional style is the blind eye without the metal eye. But there's definitely no reason to practice and learn and start with the traditional, now modern, round folded eye or looped eye style, as you can get in different brands, Partridge and TMCO even has but Partridge is one of the more popular styles. But for hooks, to really get a good history on hooks and see, you'd want to go to Ron, R-O-N-N, Lucas Sr. His website has a great area and section on it on classic flies and also on hooks. And let me get his web address here real quick. Just pulling that up. It's a great resource. He has a lot of artistic flies that are really cool. So his web address is R-O-N-N, so two N's in Ron, Lucas, L-U-C-A-S, S-R for senior, .com. And that is a great resource on history of hooks, different styles, and great on the salmon flies, too. Got a lot of really interesting artistic styles that are there.
United States Air Force, I'm saying. United States Coast Guard.
Yeah.
Names of these flies, Marine Corps. Okay.
And he does some really interesting things with the bodies on them, incorporating beads and different things. So they're very interesting.
Now, I'm curious about this, you know, this using the mono eye and attaching that to the fly. Is that something that's something they did back in the old days when they used the flies for fishing as well? And that is secure enough to hold a large salmon? Is there anything special you do to secure that?
Yeah. For actual fishing use back then, they would make that twisted silkworm gut eye extend all the way back to the back of the shank and tie it down tightly over the whole length, and it would hold well enough in that instance. Now the silkworm gut material is not cheap, and it's not easy to find, so typically you make kind of a truncated version. So you'd have the loops of the folded gut material extend back maybe a quarter of an inch or so, and then build the body up behind that. And that's where you need an underbody to build up the taper on the shank to where it matches the end of those folded gut eyes that you've tied in the front for the eye of the hook. So that's a big part after you get that folded gut eye tied in underneath the blind eye hook end in the front. You're going to have that gap behind those, and you build that up with floss as an underbody.
Okay, okay, cool. Okay, time to take a quick break again, but we'll come back. We'll talk more about tying and selecting feathers and the birds and all that. So stick with us, and we'll be right back. Baja Fly Fishing Company is dedicated to fulfilling your vacation dreams. And just so there is no mistake, they derive as much pleasure helping a novice improve as they do fishing with a pro. From the casual to the hardcore, they can match your expectations with their experience and coaching. A vacation with Baja Fly Fishing is more than a fishing trip. It's a full-on Baja experience that you will remember forever. They know the Baja after 40 years of traveling its back roads, kayaking its shoreline, surfing and snorkeling, while pioneering the fly fishing techniques that have evolved into the tactics used today. They are well-versed in fly fishing the beach, in kayaks, on pongas, and are well-versed in all tackle types. Join them in pursuit of roosterfish, dorado, marlin, sailfish, wahoo, jack crevalle, yellowfin, skipjack, and many other species. Learn more about Baja Fly Fishing Company by visiting their website at www.bajaflyfish.com. That's bajaflyfish.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Kevin Erickson about classic salmon flies. If you'd like to ask Kevin a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So let me, I think we did get a couple questions in here. Kevin, I'm going to take a good look. Phil in Kentucky asks, if you are tying flies to fish rather than for display as art, what tying features do you do differently? So, or is it a whole other world when you're tying the fish?
No, not really. If you want to tie the classic styles of flies, I just would highly recommend using substitute materials. As I said it earlier, I'd probably be using 50-pound or higher Kevlar leader material, so if I got hooked up on the bottom with a fly with authentic materials, I could pull the rock in with the fly. But there are a lot of substitutes that are out there that are very good and for fishing use are great. One of the things I wanted to kind of focus on in the book was availability and how to come up with substitutes so that you could tie these and fish them. One fly that's a traditional pattern that's kind of hard to imitate the feathers for is the pattern called the Black Argus. It uses feathers from a Western tragopan, which is rare and very limited availability feathers, kind of a pheasant, in the pheasant family, one of the birds. And the Western tragopan have a very black, dark black tip with a bright white spot in the tip of the feather. And those are put together, three of them, in sequence so that you get a black wing essentially with these three white dots on them. Well, I thought and thought and thought how I could come up with something. I've seen some people who've done like a photodyne process that looked pretty good and just different ways of doing it. And I have a newfound friend, Robert Verkirk, who has a website, classicflytying.net, and he had a substitute for a feather called blue chatterer, Cotinga, where he would take a blue feather and in front of that place a black feather to give a simulation of the color of the natural feathers. Well, I hadn't seen that until later on, but I started playing around and working and came up with a way using brass tubing of different diameters. You sharpen them in a drill bit, essentially, use a file or sandpaper and taper the end to where it's sharp. And then you take and lay out a black feather with a rounded tip, and you take a white feather and you cut half of the tube off, so you're getting just a concave end and a convex end on the other. And you cut the white feather to lay on top of the black feather and give the round half, and then you end up taking the next black feather and you cut a concave in it to lay over the white feather, creating a perfect white circle. And then you take the next white feather and you cut a convex, I guess the outer portion of the white circle. And then on the next black feather, you cut a concave opening and lay that on top. So you get, it takes, what is it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 feathers per side. But you get an exact match for how that looks as far as at a glance. And you could mix colors, and it really works well to come up with a cheap, easy substitute for that hard-to-get feather.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. And Rod Fresh Shears asked about where do you get all these crazy feathers, and we just gave out a bunch of websites for that. Rod also asked about what hooks you use. And you mentioned a few before, but are there preferred vendors that you prefer for hooks?
There are different brands you can come up with. There's Gaelic Supreme, which is good. Partridge has their Alec Jackson brand blind eye hooks that are long shanks that are real nice for some of the spay and D-style flies. So it's really personal preference. Ron Lucas's website would be good to look at that to kind of get an idea on the different styles and all. But Partridge is good, and the Alec Jackson and those Gaelic Supreme.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
And I'd probably suggest starting out with kind of a moderate size, maybe something in the 1/0 or 2/0 range, in that kind of gives you a happy medium and that it's a fairly good size fly, and yet you don't have to get it. It's not difficult to get materials to tie that size. The bigger the fly hook, the harder it is to get the right materials. And it's like building a house. If you don't have good materials, you're not going to get a good finished product.
Can't get there from here, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Craig in Portland, up in your neck of the woods, is what are a couple of tying skills that are more crucial for tying salmon flies as opposed to trout flies? And he says, I took a class from Kevin when he worked at Kaufman's. He was both an excellent instructor and tyer. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Craig. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah.
specific skills for the full dress flies would be working on smooth, even bodies, and that takes literally flattening out your thread by twisting the tying thread counterclockwise if you're a right-handed tier, and keeping the thread wraps next to each other literally as you build the bodies and tie everything in. And getting smooth, even bodies is critical, and that just takes practice to discipline yourself to do that. And then practicing, my choice would be tying muddlers, just to practice tying in those quill wings and getting them to tie in perfectly vertically and not twisting or rolling around the hook at all. And if you can get those down, you're well on your way.
Okay, okay. And you mentioned tools before, mainly really sharp, pointy scissors. And no other specialty tools then, other than
No, there are some tires that use wing crimpers and other specialized things, but these really don't need much. It's a lot of handwork, and there are certain ways that I show in the book as far as how you want to trim feathers versus stripping fibers off to control how the feathers tie in and are oriented, but it's really not a lot. The good fine point sharp scissors are probably really the most important part. Some tires use even ophthalmological scissors, eye surgery scissors,
wow,
that are
wow,
like compression style scissors that are super fine, super sharp, and
very expensive.
As long as you have something you're comfortable with, you're good. Yes.
Yeah.
They can't.
What? Out of curiosity, what? How much could you have in dollars in one of these complex flies as far as buying feathers?
Yeah, you could probably get upward of $100 if you get into something that's very complicated and has a lot of exotic, authentic materials.
And that would be just enough materials to tie that fly or enough to tie other flies as well? I mean,
oh, you'd probably be able to tie half a dozen or so out of that. But, yeah, some of them can get to be expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why you don't, you want to practice with the substitutes till you have your technique down. Then if you're ready to go for broke and tie the authentic material flies, you're going to get the most out of the materials that way. And it's nice, too. The only real thing that could happen is maybe you cut a feather too short and you can't put it back together, so... But if you tie something in and it doesn't look quite right to you, you can always unwrap it and retrim it and retie it in and kind of tweak with it until you get it the way you want it to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, see, all you fly tires out there, now here's another place you can spend more money on fly fishing that you probably don't want to tell your spouse about. So anyway, yeah, I mean, we're always kidding around. Yeah, we need another rod. We need another flat feather. Now you'll need lots of expensive feathers. So. Anyway, okay. Well, let's talk about feathers here some more. Can you you classified them differently in your book. Can you talk about the different classifications of feathers?
Yeah, there are different types depending on the use on the bird as far as, the body or contour feathers, the preening feathers. There are even some that are almost like whiskers that some of the ducks have up on their face and area for protective feathers during flight. The main ones they're using for the flies are going to be either the wing or tail feathers because of their longer fiber length, and then the contour body feathers for hackling and also up on the neck. Saying that the feathers never go to waste for the most part in fly tying because there's always somewhere you're going to use it and some way you can use it, and whether creative or following a specific pattern, it's just kind of a miracle of nature how those birds have all the same makeup and I guess really the evolution that's gone on, and
mm-hmm.
how you could have a bustard that lives in Africa and a swan that lives in Canada and a golden pheasant that lives in China, and take all those different bird feathers and pull out some fibers from the tails and wings and join them all together as if they were one wild colored bird.
Wow, yeah, Yeah. They're all made from the same design and so forth, yeah. In your book you talk, you have flight feathers and contour and down and bristle and semiplume and all, certain feathers work better for wings versus tails and so forth.
Yeah, the physical makeup, the flight feathers, typically the tail and wings are what you'd want for the married wing because of the fiber length and the makeup of those. Typically, like the breast feathers and downy feathers, softer, fluffier fibers as such are used a lot for veilings. And then the body and contour feathers in smaller sizes are used for sides and cheeks, like a real quote-unquote common feather that's used on a lot of classic salmon flies, if you can call the rare feather common, is jungle cock. And those are feathers off of the head and neck of the bird, and they literally form with kind of an enamel nail finish on them. When the roosters get more mature and the neck feathers come off, and they're actually pretty solid and rigid feathers, so they work really well for the sides and cheeks on some of the salmon flies. So the characteristics of the feathers kind of dictate how they're used. They'd be way too stiff. You wouldn't be able to get the fibers to separate and wrap as a hackle, say, or something like that. But then the tailing, the tail feathers and wing feathers of the birds work well for the main wings and underwings.
Okay. And you also talk about the anatomy of a feather, you know, the different parts, and you've been talking about the barbels and those being able to join together and so forth. What other things would a tire need to know about feathers in general that's helpful?
Well, consistency and quality. Materials make or break your fly. If you get a pack of feathers and half of them are broken, I'd say those are probably something to save for some other styles of flies. You can't really repair them or do anything. If you can go through and pick out the best quality of what you have and save that to use for your best flies, you're going to be well ahead. It's just, you know, trying to save a penny or two here or there really doesn't pay off when it comes to tying flies in general, but especially these classic flies. They're pretty discerning and specific as far as their proportions and what materials should be used where. So just try and get the best materials you can, and you'll be ahead of the game.
Okay. Time to take another quick break. So when we come back, we'll talk more about birds and feathers, and want to talk a little bit before we finish up about display. So hang in there, and we'll be with you in just a minute. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, and the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Kevin Erickson about classic salmon flies. If you have any questions, just use that form on our homepage and send it to us, and we'll try to answer your question tonight before we end. So you've mentioned a bunch of feathers throughout the night, and any particular ones that really stand out for you that super unique, or, you know, that you just love and can't do without?
Themselves? Well, I'd like to say all of them, but they're all different,
them, yeah.
Each unique characteristics. But my favorites are the peacock pheasants. They are just amazing feathers. They typically are kind of a brown mottled, pretty plain base feather, but at the tip is this metallic green-blue round circle eye. And there are flies like the leopard, or one I came up with, the Emerald Isle, that incorporates those in them. And they're very striking and very, very attractive look to the feather, and the, especially if you put them in the water, they just dance, and it's almost mesmerizing watching those. And then the other is the great Argus, the Argus pheasant, and that's a bird in Malaysia that the males have developed these mating feathers to a point where they can't even fly anymore. The secondary and primary wing quills are so long that the bird, they reach up to about 3 feet in length, and then the tail feathers reach up to about 5 feet in length, and it's evolved to a point where the bird can't even fly anymore. Wow. So they just have eyes on the wing quills, and just, again, are very striking.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Now, are there a lot of feathers that you can't get today that are used for traditional patterns?
Yeah, they're, that's where the substitutes come in, but the ones that are rare are bustards and a number of the ones I've mentioned and used. I've collected these, and I actually inherited them from grandparents and uncles when I was, before I was even old enough to walk. They'd kind of willed them to me, but then I've added to the collection over the years, so it's a lot of these that are unique in appearance, and the birds are endangered, but it's really encouraging that a lot of what I've gotten in recent times have been from hobbyists who have a business or just a hobby that they do raising these exotic birds, peacock pheasants and some of the great Argus and other species of pheasants and birds, and they raise them to produce the eggs and distribute the eggs to help perpetuate the species, and then also some of the zoos. One of the great initiatives that helps with the bustards is the Cory Bustard Species Preservation Engagement. John McLean on his website, Feathers MC, has a link to be able to contribute to that. And what they do is they'll give away some bustard feathers in exchange for donations and help preserving the species that they have in the zoos. So it's kind of a win-win situation. You can get feathers to use and also help perpetuate the species. So all kinds of different sources.
Yeah, does I did a show with Tom Whiting. And does he raise any other exotics other than chickens?
No, not that I know of. I've talked, Dave McNeese would love to raise jungle cock, but has to get something put together to keep them in. Apparently they need a pretty wide open space to be happy. But there are people who do. There was a gentleman in Washougal who had just a fairly small property, but out in the back he had all kinds of pens and a fenced-in area where he raised golden pheasants and silver pheasants and Amherst and all kinds, so you just never know where they'll pop up at.
Yeah, and I guess the trick is keeping the birds in good condition while they're growing, so that the feathers.
Yes.
Yeah, because if they, I guess they'd probably have to be raised independently, because they'd be fighting and so forth, you know.
Yeah, it's dependent on the species. They do tend to separate and have like groups of one male with several females in.
Yeah.
Segregated areas, because yeah, if you get males together, they'll tend to fight. But most of them do a pretty good job.
So, are most of the birds raised domestically, or are some still hunted in the wild? Or
domestic, yes. The more exotic species, the biggest problem is habitat loss and encroachment by civilization on their environments. But yeah, zoos are a big source for preserving and trying to enhanced species. Like golden pheasants originated in China, and but there's a feral population that's pretty big in the UK at this point. So, again, you kind of never know where they're going to pop up at.
Okay, okay. But, I mean, from a commercial standpoint, are there, is it just, I guess it's just kind of random here with all the different birds, because there's probably so many to talk about. But are there people that go collect birds in the wild for salmon fly specifically?
No,
eagle or?
Typically not. I mean, maybe golden pheasants and some of the other species, but typically not. It's more of a matter of having to find a source where you could, one, find the bird, and then, two, find it to, you know, where the feathers are available either individually or if the birds have died, you hope not. But if so, then sometimes you can actually get the whole skin of the bird. So.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And we already talked about some trusted sources for feathers. You were shared those websites, which is great. Rod just wrote in on the internet here. Wants to know, what's the most complicated fly to tie?
Well, it's dependent on what you consider complicated or difficult. Some people consider the spey flies pretty hard to tie just because of the way the hackle has to be wrapped around. But to me, the most involved is like the Jock Scott or some of the traditional classic full dress flies where there are so many materials that you're trying to cram in on a hook and getting the proportions right and all the lengths and things correct and even the number of strips that you use. You want to try and be consistent. If you're going to use 4 strips per color, be sure you get 4 strips per color. It shows. If you get 5 in one and 3 in another when you're building up those married wings. So, yeah, the traditional built-wing married strip flies, to me, are the most involved and complicated to tie.
Do you find yourself using maybe less wraps than you would in a fly that you're actually fishing, one for display, and do you use cement along the way to hold things in place?
That's a good question. You typically are using 2 different types of threads as you build the fly. Through the construction of adding the eye in and the body of the fly, the tail, the underbody, and then the actual body of the fly, you're using a little bit bigger, heavier thread to really kind of lash everything down tightly. But then I have switched over and will tie that thread off, and when I get to the point of tying in the wings and everything else beyond that, I switch over and actually tied using the 8-0 Unimage thread. It's very fine, very strong. It bites into the materials real well and holds things together pretty good. If I were building flies for fishing use, I would probably just use that 8-0 Unithread all the way through start to finish, and it really works well and grabs hold of the materials well to hold them in. I don't tend to cement things very much, except at the end if I'm doing hair wing flies, I'll put maybe a drop of cement in the hair butts as I tie it down just to help hold those and lock them in. But, no, I don't use anything along the way on any of the classic patterns.
Okay. Okay. And what do you finish the head with? Because always looks so beautiful. Is it a particular kind of head cement or lacquer or something?
I've used the old style Price wet head cement, and it just takes about 3 coats to build it up and get it to where it's smooth and glossy, but that's worked well. Some use epoxy. I've had a hard time with epoxy because it's pretty thick and viscous, and you have to have a rotator, and it takes a bit to cure. You could use lacquer, but it tends to age and kind of fracture and break off sometimes if you don't get it soaked in well all the way through to where you kind of have a solid base for the final coat. That Price wet head cements work great.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's talk a little bit about then. Oh, one of the things, I guess if you're buying a lot of these flies over the internet from these sources and stuff, you just have to kind of trust in the dealer and that they're going to give you, good quality feathers. You're really not able to hand select them for the most part. Is that correct? Yeah.
So. That's correct. And the best thing you can do is, if you buy over internet or over the phone or whatever, is just be descriptive. What are you going to use it for? What kind of characteristics do you want? Like if you order turkey quills, and you might want to say that to whomever you order from that, okay, I'm going to be tying this for 4-aught, so I need fiber length of at least, you know, 3 inches or so, and it shouldn't be warped or twisted fibers. You want them pretty smooth and flat. And just try and let them know what you want and what you want to use it for, and then the good sources should help pick that out as if they were going to use it themselves.
That's great. That's a great tip to know. Yeah. Okay. And then lastly, with our last few minutes here, can you give us some, ideas or direction on displaying the flies, different methods and ones you use? Maybe what's more commonly done than others?
I've kind of gotten something unique that I've done, and I've liked in that I'm really into the photography end of it as well. So I photographed the flies against kind of a water-type background, and then I would take that and blow up into a 11 by 14 or so, and with a Photoshop program kind of fade out a little oval area and mount the fly in the oval. So that from a distance, you see a photograph of a large fly, and then when you get up close, you see the actual fly that made the photograph framed with it as well. Different ways you can frame them. Some people like shadow boxes with clear plastic tubes that have wire running through from the back and are looped around the hook bend and hold the fly suspended up off of the background. I've gone and used clear either mono or other material to punch a couple of little holes with like a bodkin needle through the background and just loop that around the hook bend and through the hook eye and pin it against the background if I'm using solid colors. But I like the oval frames, or oval matting, I should say, in a conventional frame. And mm-hmm. It just depends on how you want it to be displayed and what you want to have for a background, if anything.
Is do you know of any books or tutorials or videos about, you know, creating those shadow boxes or whatever?
No, I don't. I'm sorry. I haven't gotten into. But I know there are some out there. So, yeah, some searches online for how to mount flies or display flies would be worthwhile for more information.
Yeah. And lastly, what do you think the future of tying classic salmon flies is? Is it still a thriving art? Is it a dying art? Is it going to be impossible because of lack of materials at some point?
I think if somebody can create an app that would go through it, it might spur on some more interest. But I think it's something I kind of also wanted to hopefully revive a little bit, or maybe gain some new interest in by getting the book out and showing what it is. It's still going, still in a lot of enthusiasts. I know on Facebook I'm on and active, and there's a lot of different pages and groups addicted to fly tying and classic salmon flies and all about feathers. And there's a lot of people out there who are interested in it. It's just kind of widespread and a matter of sharing the word and hopefully the book that you can have in hand and something that you could follow through step by step to tie the flies will help.
Right.
And you know, the apps and videos are good, but it's kind of hard to pause a YouTube video while you're tying and do something and then back it up or go through. But whatever works for you.
Yeah. Well, I kind of think of it as something that, especially for tires that, may even have trouble getting out on the river, because of age or something. It's something you could do in retirement that would keep you plenty busy and, plenty interested. That could be a project for that time of your life as well. So.
Yeah, and I'm actually encouraged, too, to start tying up. I'm going to do those black Argus and some color variations, like purple with an orange spot. I know I'd be the only person out in the water who'd have anything that looks like that. And with the substitute method I've come up with, I could have a box full of those, and it wouldn't hurt too much to lose them. So that'll encourage me to get out fishing more.
Oh, I may have just I just happened to grab your book, and it opened it up, and there are the three dots. I wasn't even looking for it, but just as you said it, I was kind of flipping through. Yeah, that's a very interesting looking fly. Yeah. Very cool. Well, good. Well, time to wrap things up here, and but stick with me here. Just a couple more minutes, everyone. We're going to give away the one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, as well as a copy of Kevin's book, Feathercraft, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And, of course, you can go to Kevin's website to get the book. You could also get it from Stackpole and Amazon. I saw it there. So it's all over the place. And only one person's going to win tonight, so the rest of you should go out and buy this book. So check it out. It's a beautiful book. Kevin did a wonderful job on it. And very detailed and descriptive. It's not just pictures, but a lot of description on how to tie these flies. So I know you'll enjoy it. So stick with us. We'll be right back, and we'll do those giveaways. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where a successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. Time to stop the Chewitna Coal Strip Mine. For more information about how you can help, visit SaveTheChewitna.org. SaveTheChewitna.org. And Chewitna is C-H-U-I-T-N-A. So SaveTheChewitna.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of the show?" Just click on the link and leave your comments, and we'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away a few prizes, and the winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. So if you haven't registered yet for tonight's show, it's too late. But make sure you do so for the next show, and because you don't want to miss out on possibly winning one of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show to provide you with information on how to receive your gift. So first, we will be giving a one-year membership to the International Federation of Fly Fishers. To learn more about the International Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. So we'll fire up the database here. And let's see here. Okay, it looks like we've got Richard Clark. Richard Clark in Florida. Oh, boy, Florida. I just think about all my buddies down there, all the guides and stuff in Florida and the guests we've had on our show. They're just going to get hammered, and the fishing industry is going to get hammered down there too. So hopefully they'll be a little bit lucky and the thing will swing to the right, that hurricane. But anyway, Richard, congratulations, and we'll send you out an email to get your information and get you signed up for your membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And then our next giveaway is going to be a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And that is published by Amato Books, AmatoBooks.com. Amato Books produces all kinds of periodicals and books on fly fishing and other outdoor sports. So check them out, and they're a good source for information. Okay, and it looks like our winner is going to be Daniel Inns. Daniel Inns, also in Florida. Oh, boy. Lucky on Ask About Fly Fishing, but not lucky in weather this month. So, Daniel, congratulations, and I hope you enjoy your subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And he may see some of your work in there shortly again, huh, Kevin?
Yes. I've been asked to contribute a whole series of articles for the next year, so I've got some interesting things coming out.
Cool. Good. Very cool. Okay, now time to give away Kevin's book. So we're going to ask a question here. Actually, I'm going to make it a two-part question. If it gets too hard, we'll see. So the first part is Kevin recommended a certain style of fly to get started with as far as tying salmon flies. What was the name of that style of fly? And what was one of his favorite birds that has incredible feathers? He mentioned a couple of those. So give me those two answers, and you've got Kevin's book, if you're first. So I'm just going through my queue here, Kevin, waiting for some answers. And meanwhile, we'll hope that I didn't make the question too hard. But it's such a nice book, we can't just give it away on an easy question. So we shall see. We've got some really good note takers. Well, we got an answer, but it's not right. Part of it, Dr. Peacock Pheasant. The doctor is not what I was looking for. Peacock Pheasant happens to be correct. And let's see here. I've got one who didn't put their name in. Let's see if we've got any other guesses here. This one is the doctor and the bustard. Everybody thinks that it was the doctor, but it was something else I was looking for. We don't get the right muddler and pheasant, no. Silver doctor, peacock pheasant, no. A lot of people are guessing doctors, so maybe we weren't too clear about that. Let's do this. Since there was obvious confusion, I'm going to go back here and let's see. And that first answer was doctor and peacock pheasant. So since everybody was guessing doctor, I'm going to give it to Joe Herndon, who was the first one that answered the question, and he answered with doctor and peacock pheasant. So we'll go with Joe. Sometimes the questions aren't the greatest. So thanks for trying, everybody out there. And you were getting the general idea here. So, Joe, congratulations. You got yourself a beautiful book. Send me your name and your email address. Send me in the same text box your mailing address so that we can get Stackpole to send one of these out to you. So thanks for playing, everybody. I appreciate it, and I always appreciate you listening to the show. Kevin, really want to thank you for being with us and taking time out to do this. It's always a load of fun, and I learned a whole lot tonight. So thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure. Always fun to talk about flies and fishing.
Oh, yeah. Always fun. Hopefully all of you have found the archive on our website. If you haven't, there are a couple of links to it on our homepage and links at the bottom of every page. And in the archive, you'll find all of our past shows, over 160, which you can search by keyword or keyword phrase like trout or tarpon or salmon flies. And so go ahead and explore. You'll be pleasantly surprised at what you're going to discover there. Lots of learning to be done. Our next broadcast will be on September 20th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'll interview Tim Lockhart. And Tim's been on a show before talking about still waters. This show is going to be called Stillwater Simplified. And Tim is a stillwater fly fishing junkie. He's like Kevin, the fly fishing junkie, and we all are. And stillwaters are, you know, provide some of the best opportunities for big fish. So still waters have intimidated you in the past. Get ready for an awakening. Just join us and learn about critical lessons for catching more trout in lakes, ponds, and reservoirs. And we'd like to thank the International Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Whipray Key Fishing Lodge, Watermaster, and Baja Fly Fishing Company for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements. You don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you've enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.